differentiate them from the Hitan who had stayed in the east. The Mongols called them Kara Hitan, the Black Hitan. Since black both signified distant kin, and was in particular the color that symbolized the West. While many of the Uyghurs had voluntarily joined the Mongols, others remained under the control of the Black Hitan, who were now ruled by Güçlük, the son of the Tayang Khan of the Naiman, Genghis Khan's erstwhile enemy. After the defeat of his people, Güçlük fled to the south, where he married the daughter of the Black Hitan ruler, and then usurped his power. Although Güçlük was originally a Christian, and the Black Hitan were Buddhists, they shared a common mistrust of the Uyghur subjects, who were Muslims. In his newly acquired position as ruler of the kingdom, Güçlük began to persecute his Muslim subjects by limiting the practice of their religion. He forbade the call to prayer, and prohibited public worship or religious study. When Güçlük left the capital of Balasagun on a campaign, his subjects closed the city gates behind him and tried to prevent his return. In retaliation, he besieged the capital, conquered it, and then razed it. Without a Muslim ruler willing to protect them, the Muslims of Balasagun turned to Genghis Khan to overthrow their oppressive king. Though the Mongol army was stationed 2,500 miles away, Genghis Khan ordered Jeb, the general who restored the Hitan monarchy, to lead 20,000 Mongol soldiers across the length of Asia and defend the Muslims. Genghis Khan's refusal to take to the battlefield himself indicates how low a priority these lands held for him. His world was in Mongolia, and he wanted to spend as much time as he could with his family at the Avraga encampment along the banks of the Harlan River. The distant oasis cities of the desert and mountains held little attraction for him. This particular invasion offered him little more than an opportunity to finally deal with his old enemy, Güçlük. Because the Mongols conducted the campaign at the request of the Uyghur Muslims, they did not allow plunder, destroy property, or endanger the lives of civilians. Instead, Jeb's army defeated the army of Güçlük, and, in a punishment befitting his crimes, had him beheaded on a plain near the modern borders of Afghanistan, Pakistan, and China. Following the execution, the Mongols sent a herald to Kashgar to proclaim the end of religious persecution and the restoration of religious freedom in each community. According to the Persian historian Juveni, the people of Kashgar proclaimed the Mongols to be one of the mercies of the Lord and one of the bounties of divine grace. Although Persian and other Muslim chroniclers recorded the episode in tremendous detail, the secret history summed up the entire campaign in one simple sentence. Jeb pursued Güçlük Khan of the Naiman, overtook him at the Yellow Cliff, destroyed him, and came home. From the Mongol perspective, that is probably all that mattered. Jeb had done his duty. He killed the enemy and returned home safely. The campaign tested and proved the ability of the Mongol army to successfully operate over thousands of miles from the home base and apart from Genghis Khan himself. More important than acquiring new subjects or building his reputation as the defender of persecuted religions, the victory over the Black Hitan gave Genghis Khan complete control over the Silk Route between the Chinese and the Muslims. He now had vassal states among the Tangut, the Uyghurs, the Black Hitan, and the northern Jurchid lands. And although he controlled neither the primary production area of the Sung dynasty nor the primary purchasing areas in the Middle East, he controlled the links between. With his control over large amounts of Chinese trade goods, he saw tremendous opportunities for trade with the Muslim countries of Central Asia and the Middle East. In 1219, with many military and commercial accomplishments behind him, Genghis Khan neared 60 years of age. As Juvaini describes, he had brought about complete peace and quiet, and security and tranquility, and had achieved the extreme of prosperity and well-being. The roads were secure and disturbances allayed. He seemed content to live out his days in peace, to enjoy his family and horses, and to bask in the new prosperity he had brought to his people. He had far more goods now than he could possibly use or distribute to his people, and he wanted to use this vast amount of new resources to stimulate trade. In addition to the thriving supply of traditional Asian goods, other commodities sometimes trickled in from the more distant and exotic western lands of the Middle East. The Muslims in that part of the world produced the finest of all metals, the magnificent gleaming steel. They had cottons and other fine textiles, and they knew the mysterious process of making glass. The vast area from the mountains of modern Afghanistan to the Black Sea fell under the power of the Turkic Sultan Muhammad II, whose empire was called Khwarizm. Genghis Khan wanted these exotic commodities, and toward this end, he sought a trading partnership with the distant sultan. The French historian Petit explained Genghis Khan's situation at the time. This emperor, having nothing more to fear either from the east, west, or northern parts of Asia, endeavored to cultivate a sincere friendship with the king of Khwarizm. He therefore, toward the latter end of this year, 1217, sent three ambassadors to him with presents, to ask that their people might trade together with safety, and find in a perfect union with one another that repose and plenty, which are the chief blessings that can be wished for in all kingdoms. To negotiate a trade treaty and formalize the commercial relations, Genghis Khan sent an envoy to the Sultan of Khwarizm. "I have the greatest desire to live in peace with you. I shall look on you as my son. For your part, you are not unaware that I have conquered North China and subjected all the tribes of the north. You know that my country is an ant heap of warriors, a mine of silver, and that I have no need to covet other dominions. We have an equal interest in fostering trade between our subjects." With some suspicion and reluctance, the Sultan agreed to the treaty. Since the Mongols themselves were not merchants, Genghis Khan turned to the Muslim and Hindu merchants already operating in his newly acquired territories of the Uyghur. From among them, he assembled 450 merchants and retainers, whom he sent from Mongolia to Khwarizm with a caravan loaded with the luxury commodities of white camel cloth, Chinese silk, silver bars, and raw jade. He sent an Indian at the head of the delegation with another message of friendship to the Sultan, inviting trade so that henceforth the abscess of evil thoughts may be lanced by the improvement of relations and agreement between us, and the pus of sedition and rebellion removed. When the caravan entered Khwarizm in the northwestern province of Otrar, now located in southern Kazakhstan, the arrogant and greedy governor seized the goods and killed the merchants and their drivers. He had no idea what a grievous response would follow. As the Persian observer Juvaini explained, the governor's attack not only wiped out a caravan, it laid waste a whole world. Hearing of the episode, Genghis Khan sent envoys to request that the Sultan punish the local official for the attack. Instead, the Sultan rebuked the Khan in the most publicly dramatic and offensive manner he knew. He killed some of the envoys and mutilated the faces of the others, whom he sent back to their master. It only took a few weeks for word of the rebuke to fly across the steppes and reach the Mongol court. where, in the words of Juvenal, the whirlwind of anger cast dust into the eyes of patience and clemency, while the fire of wrath flared up with such a flame that it drove the water from his eyes and could be quenched only by the shedding of blood. In anger, humiliation, and frustration, Genghis Khan withdrew once again to his mountain top of Burhan Khaldun, where he uncovered his head, turned his face toward the earth, and for 3 days and nights offered up prayer, saying, "I was not the author of this trouble. Grant me strength to exact vengeance." Thereupon he descended from the hill, meditating action and making ready for war. Chapter 5. Sultan versus Khan. War, for the nomadic people, was a sort of production. For the warriors it meant success and riches. Sechen Jagjit. Essays in Mongolian Studies. Genghis Khan set out to the west, heading for Khwarizm in 1219, the year of the rabbit, and arrived with the following spring in the year of the dragon, when he crossed the desert to suddenly appear deep behind enemy lines at Bukhara. Before the year ended, the Mongols had taken every major city in the Khwarizm Empire, and its sultan lay abandoned and dying on a small island out in the Caspian Sea, where he had sought refuge from the relentless hounding by Genghis Khan's warriors. The Mongols carried the fighting deeper into the new lands, and in a campaign of 4 years, they conquered the cities of Central Asia as though swatting flies. The names seemed to run together in a numbing sequence of syllables in a dozen languages. Bukhara, Samarkand, Otrar, Urgench, Balkh, Banakat, Hojent, Merv, Nisa, Nishapur, Termez, Herat, Bamyan, Ghazni, Peshawar, Qazvin, Hamadan, Ardabil, Marage, Tabriz, Tbilisi, Derbent, Astrakhan. The armies of Genghis Khan crushed every army wherever they found them, from the Himalayan mountains to the Caucasus mountains, from the Indus River to the Volga River. Each conquered city had its own story that followed a mildly different course of events, but the results never varied. No city withstood their onslaught. No citadel survived untaken. No prayers could save the people. No officials could bribe or talk their way out of submission. Nothing could slow, much less stop, the Mongol juggernaut. By riding against Khwarizm, Genghis Khan attacked a newly formed kingdom only 12 years older than his own Mongol nation. But he attacked not just an empire, but an entire ancient civilization. The Muslim lands of the 13th century, combining Arabic, Turkic, and Persian civilizations, were the richest countries in the world, and the most sophisticated in virtually every branch of learning, from astronomy to the mathematics to agronomy and linguistics, and possessed the world's highest levels of literacy among the general population. Compared with Europe and India, where only priests could read, or China, where only government bureaucrats could, nearly every village in the Muslim world had at least some men who could read the Quran and interpret Muslim law. While Europe, China, and India had only attained the level of regional civilizations, the Muslims came closest to having a world-class civilization, with more sophisticated commerce, technology, and general learning, but because they ranked so high above the rest of the world, they had the farthest to fall. The Mongol invasion caused more damage here than anywhere else their horses would tread. Just as in northern China, when the formerly nomadic Khitan, Jurchid, and Tangut tribes ruled over peasant populations, across the Middle East, The formerly nomadic Turkic tribes, such as the Seljuks and the Turkoman, had conquered and ruled various kingdoms populated mostly by farmers. A series of Turkic states dominated the political landscape from the territories of modern-day India, Pakistan, and Afghanistan across Persia and into the heart of the Anatolia region of modern Turkey along the Mediterranean. The civilization of the area rested on an ancient bed of Persian cultures, heavily augmented by influences from the Arab world and from earlier classical civilizations from Rome to India. The cultural mosaic of the Middle East included sizable minority populations of Jews, Christians, and other religious and linguistic groups. Overall, however, the scholars, judges, and religious leaders spoke Arabic and quoted the Quran. The soldiers spoke the Turkic dialects of their warrior tribe. The peasants spoke and sang in the many dialects of Persian. Despite the wealth of the area at the time of Genghis Khan's sudden appearance, the complexity of its social life left its many kingdoms riven with political rivalries, religious tensions, and cultural hatreds. As an upstart Turk, the Sultan of Khwarizm could scarcely claim any allies among his fellow Muslims, mostly Arabs and Persians, who looked upon him as little more than a barbarian conqueror himself. Relations between the Sultan of Khwarizm and the Arab Caliph in Baghdad were so strained that, according to several chronicles, the Caliph supposedly petitioned Genghis Khan to attack the Sultan by sending him a secret message tattooed on a man's head, who then passed undetected through Khwarizm territory to reach the Mongols. Although apocryphal, the story of the tattooed messenger circulated widely in the Muslim world and conferred a certain legitimacy on Genghis Khan's war against the Sultan for those Muslims looking for a religious reason to side with the infidel against a Muslim Sultan. According to a possibly true story, the Caliph further aided the Mongol attack by sending Genghis Khan a gift of a regiment of crusaders captured in the Holy Land. Since Genghis Khan had no need for infantry, he freed them, and some of them eventually made their way home to Europe, with the first rumors of the previously unknown Mongol conquerors. In addition to the strains with his Muslim neighbors, the Sultan of Khwarizm faced numerous divisions within his own lands and family. The Sultan quarreled constantly with his mother, who held virtually as much power as he did, and the threat of a Mongol invasion heightened their disagreement on everything, from how to run the empire to how to prepare for war. It was her brother who had seized the first Mongol caravan that precipitated the war, but in refusing to allow her son to punish him and thereby avoid war, she exacerbated the tensions with the Mongols. If the stresses within the ruling family were not menacing enough, the masses of Persian and Tajik subjects showed little connection to their rulers, and even less to the Turkic soldiers who were stationed in their cities to exploit them rather than defend them. In turn, the soldiers had minimal vested interest in protecting the lands where they were stationed, and they showed little inclination to risk their lives to save people whom they despised. When Genghis Khan dropped down on the cities of Khwarizm, he commanded an army of about 100,000 to 125,000 horsemen. Supplemented by Uyghur and other Turkic allies, a corps of Chinese doctors and engineers for a total of 150,000 to 200,000 men. By comparison, the Khwarizm ruler had some 400,000 men under arms across his empire, and they were fighting with the home advantage on their own territory. The Mongols promised justice to those who surrendered, but they swore destruction to those who resisted. If the people accepted, and acted as relatives should by reciprocating the offer of kinship by offering food, then the Mongols would treat them as family members with a guarantee of protection and certain basic familial rights. If they refused, they would be treated as enemies. Genghis Khan's offer to the besieged was as simple as it was horrifying. as when he sent this message to the citizens of Nishapur. Commanders, elders, and commonality, know that God has given me the empire of the earth from the east to the west. Whoever submits shall be spared, but those who resist, they shall be destroyed with their wives, children, and dependents. The same sentiment found expression in many documents of the era. One of the clearest in the Armenian Chronicle that quotes Genghis Khan as saying that it is the will of God that we take the earth and maintain order, to impose Mongol law and taxes, and to those who refused them, the Mongols were obligated to slay them and destroy their place, so that the others who hear and see should fear and not act the same. Some cities surrendered without fighting. Others fought for a few days or weeks, and only the hardiest of defenders held out for more than a few months. Genghis Khan had learned much from his campaigns against the Jurchid cities. Not only how to capture heavily fortified cities, but how to treat them afterward. In particular, how to most efficiently plunder them. He did not want to repeat the mistakes of the chaotic plunder of Zhongdu. In Khorezm, he introduced the new and more efficient system of first emptying the city of all people and animals before beginning to loot, thereby minimizing the danger to his men as they plundered. Before the plundering began, the Mongol warriors followed a similar procedure toward the enemy population in each hostile city. First, they killed the soldiers. The Mongols, dependent on cavalry, had little use for an infantry trained to defend fortress walls, and more important, they did not want to leave a large army of former enemies blocking the route between them and their homeland in Mongolia. They always wanted a clear, open way home. After executing the soldiers, the Mongol officers sent clerks to divide the civilian population by profession. Professional people included anyone who could read and write in any language. Clerks, doctors, astronomers, judges, soothsayers, engineers, teachers, imams, rabbis, or priests. The Mongols particularly needed merchants, cameleers, and people who spoke multiple languages, as well as craftsmen. These workers would be put to use by the Mongols, who themselves practiced no crafts other than war, herding, and hunting. Their growing empire needed skilled workers in almost every service imaginable, including smiths, potters, carpenters, furniture makers, weavers, leather workers, dyers, miners, paper makers, glass blowers, tailors, jewelers, musicians, barbers, singers, entertainers, apothecaries, and cooks. People without occupations were collected to help in the attack on the next city by carrying loads, digging fortifications, serving as human shields, being pushed into moats as fill, or otherwise giving their lives in the Mongol war effort. Those who did not qualify even for these tasks, the Mongol warriors slaughtered and left behind. In Genghis Khan's conquest of Central Asia, one group suffered the worst fate of those captured. The Mongol captors slaughtered the rich and powerful. Under the chivalrous rules of warfare, as practiced in Europe and the Middle East during the Crusades, enemy aristocrats displayed superficial and often pompous respect for one another, while freely slaughtering common soldiers. Rather than kill their aristocratic enemy on the battlefield, they preferred to capture him as a hostage, whom they could ransom back to his family or country. The Mongols did not share this code. To the contrary, they sought to kill all the aristocrats as quickly as possible in order to prevent future wars against them. And Genghis Khan never accepted enemy aristocrats into his army, and rarely into his service in any capacity. Genghis Khan had not always pursued this policy. In the first conquests of the cities of the Jurchid, the Tangut, and the Black Hitan, Genghis Khan had often protected the rich, and even allowed rulers to stay in office after he defeated them. But the Jurchid and the Tangut had betrayed him as soon as his army withdrew. By the time Genghis Khan arrived in the Muslim countries of Central Asia, he had learned his lesson about the loyalty, dependability, and usefulness of the rich and powerful. In his keen awareness of public attitudes and opinions, he also recognized that the common people cared little about what befell the idle rich. By killing the aristocrats, the Mongols essentially decapitated the social system of their enemies and minimized future resistance. Some of the cities never recovered enough to rebuild after the loss of aristocrats on the battlefield, or from the annihilation of their families. Genghis Khan wanted office holders who were loyal and indebted to the Mongols alone for their positions of power and prestige. And for this reason, he recognized no titles other than those granted by him. Even an allied prince or king who wished to retain an older title had to have it reconferred on him by the Mongol authorities. In his report on his trip to Mongolia from 1245 to 1247, the papal envoy Giovanni di Plano Carpini complained frequently about the lack of respect that Mongols showed the aristocratic people. The lowest-ranking Mongol could walk in front of visiting kings and queens and speak rudely to them. The fate of the Sultan's mother, who had been the most powerful woman in the empire, showed the Mongol attitude toward aristocratic women. They captured her and killed most members of her court and some 24 members of her family. Then they sent her off to live the remaining decade of her life in ignominious servitude in Mongolia, where she disappeared from history. Such a woman earned no prestige or consideration by virtue of her birth. She, like a captured man, was only as good as her skills, work, and service. When the Mongols passed through a city, they left little of value behind them. In a letter written just after the invasion, the geographer Hakut al-Hamawi, who barely escaped the Mongols, wrote glowingly of the beautiful and luxurious palaces that the Mongols had effaced from off the earth, as lines of writing are effaced from paper. And those abodes became a dwelling for the owl and the raven. And in those places the screech owls answer each other's cries. And in those halls the winds moan. Genghis Khan epitomized ruthlessness in the eyes of the Muslims. Chroniclers of the era attribute to Genghis Khan the highly unlikely statement that the greatest joy a man can know is to conquer his enemies and drive them before him, to ride their horses and take away their possessions, to see the faces of those who were dear to them bedewed with tears, and to clasp their wives and daughters in his arms. Rather than finding such apocalyptic descriptions derogatory, Genghis Khan seemed to have encouraged them. With his penchant for finding a use for everything he encountered, he devised a powerful way to exploit the high literacy rate of the Muslim people and turned his unsuspecting enemies into a potent weapon for shaping public opinion. Terror, he realized, was best spread not by the acts of warriors, but by the pens of scribes and scholars. In an era before newspapers, the letters of the intelligentsia played a primary role in shaping public opinion, and in the conquest of Central Asia, they played their role quite well on Genghis Khan's behalf. The Mongols operated a virtual propaganda machine that consistently inflated the number of people killed in battle and spread fear wherever its words carried. By August 1221, only a year into the campaign, Mongol officials sent their Korean subjects a demand for 100,000 sheets of their famous paper. The volume of paper shows how rapidly Mongol record-keeping was increasing as the size of the empire grew. But the order also symbolized the Mongol emphasis on writing their history. Increasingly, paper was the most potent weapon in Genghis Khan's arsenal. He showed no interest in having his accomplishments recorded or in panegyrics to his prowess. Instead, he allowed people to freely circulate the worst and most incredible stories about him and the Mongols. From every conquered city, the Mongols sent forth delegations to the other cities to tell them of the unprecedented horrors inflicted by the nearly supernatural abilities of Genghis Khan's warriors. The power of those words can still be felt in the accounts of eyewitnesses recorded by chroniclers such as the historian Ibn al-Athir, who lived through the era of the conquest in Mosul, a city now located in Iraq, but at that time close to but slightly beyond the Mongol campaign. He recorded the accounts of refugees in his book Al-Kamil fi at-Tarikh, known in English as The Perfect History, or The Complete History. At first, Ibn al-Athir seemed disinclined to believe the accounts. Stories have been related to me, which the hearer can scarcely credit, as to the terror of the Tatars. But he quickly warmed to the retelling. It is said that a single one of them would enter a village or a quarter wherein were many people, and would continue to slay them one after another, none daring to stretch forth his hand against this horseman. From another account, he heard that one of them took a man captive, but had not with him any weapon wherewith to kill him, and he said to his prisoner, "Lay your head on the ground and do not move." And he did so, and the Tatar went and fetched his sword, and slew him therewith. Each victory released a flood of new propaganda, and the belief in Genghis Khan's invincibility spread. As absurd as the stories appear from a reasoned distance and safety in time, they had a tremendous impact across Central Asia. Ibn al-Athir lamented the Mongol conquests as the announcement of the death blow of Islam and the Muslims. With a touch of the dramatic, he added, "Oh, would that my mother had not borne me, or that I had died and become a forgotten thing ere this befell." He agreed to write out the gory details, only because a number of my friends urged me to set it down in writing. He declared the invasion as the greatest catastrophe and the most dire calamity which befell all men generally and the Muslims in particular, since God Almighty created Adam until now. By comparison, he noted that the worst slaughters in pre-Mongol history had been unleashed upon the Jews, but the attack of the Mongols on the Muslims was worse, because of the toll of Muslims whom they massacred in a single city exceeded all the children of Israel. Lest the reader prove too suspicious, Ibn al-Athir promised details about the Mongol deeds which horrify all who hear of them, and which you shall, please God, see set forth in full detail in their proper connection. The impassioned rhetoric, however, seems to have been more an effort to arouse his fellow Muslims than to accurately chronicle their conquest. Although the army of Genghis Khan killed at an unprecedented rate and used death almost as a matter of policy, and certainly as a calculated means of creating terror, they deviated from standard practices of the time in an important and surprising way. The Mongols did not torture, mutilate, or maim. War during that time was often a form of combat and terror, and other contemporary rulers used the simple and barbaric tactic of instilling terror and horror into people through public torture or gruesome mutilation. In an August 1228 battle with Jalal al-Din, the son of the Sultan, 400 Mongol prisoners fell into enemy hands, and they knew well that they would die. The victors took the Mongol warriors to nearby Isfahan, tied them behind horses, and dragged them through the streets of the city to entertain the city's residents. All the Mongol prisoners were thus killed as public sport and then fed to dogs. Because of this public torture, the Mongols never forgave the civilized people of that city. And it, too, would eventually pay a price. In another case where a Mongol army lost a battle, the Persian victors killed the captives by driving nails into their heads, the seat of their souls according to Mongol belief. This episode was echoed a century later in 1305, when the Sultan of Delhi turned the deaths of other Mongol prisoners into public entertainment by having them crushed by elephants. He then built a tower from the severed heads of the Mongols who had been killed or captured in battle. Civilized rulers and religious leaders from China to Europe depended upon these gruesome displays to control their own people through fear and to discourage potential enemies through horror. When the Byzantine Christian emperor Basil defeated the Bulgarians in 1014, he had 15,000 Bulgarian war captives blinded. He left one man out of each 100 with one eye, in order that he might lead the other 99 homeward, and thereby spread the terror. When the Christian crusaders took cities such as Antioch in 1098 and Jerusalem in 1099, they slaughtered the Jews and Muslims without regard for age or gender, but merely because of their religion. Holy Roman Emperor Frederick Barbarossa, who ranks as one of Germany's greatest historical and cultural heroes, best exemplified the use of terror in the West. When he tried to conquer the Lombard city of Cremona in the north of modern Italy in 1160, he instituted an escalating series of violent acts of terror. His men beheaded their prisoners and played with the heads outside the city walls, kicking them like balls. The defenders of Cremona then brought out their German prisoners on the city walls and pulled their limbs off in front of their comrades. The Germans gathered more prisoners and executed them in a mass hanging. The city officials responded by hanging the remainder of their prisoners on top of the city walls. Instead of fighting each other directly, the two armies continued their escalation of terror. The Germans then gathered captive children and strapped them into their catapults, which were normally used to batter down walls and break through gates. With the power of these great siege machines, they hurled the living children at the city walls. By comparison with the terrifying acts of civilized armies of the era, the Mongols did not inspire fear by the ferocity or cruelty of their acts, so much as by the speed and efficiency with which they conquered, and their seemingly total disdain for the lives of the rich and powerful. The Mongols unleashed terror as they rode east, but their campaign was more noteworthy for its unprecedented military success against powerful armies and seemingly impregnable cities than for its bloodlust or ostentatious use of public cruelty. Those cities that surrendered to the Mongols at first found their treatment so mild and benign, in comparison with the horrific stories that circulated, that they naively doubted the abilities of the Mongols in other areas as well. After surrendering, a large number of the cities waited obediently until the Mongols had passed well beyond their country and then revolted. Since the Mongols left only a few officials in charge and stationed no military detachment to guard a city, the inhabitants misinterpreted the Mongol withdrawal as weakness and presumed that the main Mongol army would never return that way. For these cities, The Mongols showed no mercy. They returned quickly to the rebels and destroyed them utterly. An annihilated city could not revolt again. One of the worst slaughters was unleashed on the citizens of Omar Khayyam's home city of Nishapur. The residents revolted against the Mongols, and in the ensuing battle, an arrow fired from walls of the city killed Genghis Khan's son-in-law Tokuchar. In revenge for the revolt, and as a lesson to other cities, Genghis allowed his widowed daughter, who was pregnant at the time, to administer whatever revenge she wished upon the captured city. She reportedly decreed death for all. And in April 1221, the soldiers carried out her command. According to widely circulated but unverified stories, she ordered the soldiers to pile the heads of the dead citizens in three separate pyramids, one each for the men, the women, and the children. Then she supposedly ordered that the dogs, the cats, and all other living animals in the city be put to death, so that no living creature would survive the murder of her husband. The most painful episode for Genghis Khan personally occurred during a battle in the beautiful valley of Bamiyan in Afghanistan, a Buddhist pilgrimage site and home of the largest statues in the world. Ancient devotees had carved giant images of Buddha in the mountainside, and one can only wonder what the Mongols thought of such large images. During the battle there, an arrow struck and killed young Mutajin, Genghis Khan's favorite grandson. Genghis Khan received word of the death before the boy's father Chagatai was informed. Genghis Khan summoned his son, and before telling him what had happened, ordered Chagatai not to weep or mourn. Genghis Khan had cried publicly many times in his life, and at the least provocation. He had cried in fear, in anger, and in sadness. But faced with the death of one whom he loved more than any other, Genghis Khan did not allow himself or his sons to show their pain and anguish through tears or mourning. Whenever faced with great difficulty or personal pain, Genghis Khan funneled it into combat. Kill. Don't mourn. He transformed the painful sorrow into a great fury that he poured out over the people of the valley. No one, rich or poor, beautiful or ugly, good or bad, would survive. The valley was eventually resettled by the Hazara, a name that meant 10,000 in Persian, who claimed to be descendants from one of Genghis Khan's regiments of that size. While the destruction of many cities was complete, the numbers given by historians over the years were not merely exaggerated or fanciful, they were preposterous. The Persian chronicles reported that at the Battle of Nishapur, the Mongols slaughtered the staggeringly precise number of 1,747,000. This surpassed the 1,600,000 listed as killed in the city of Herat. In more outrageous claims, Jujani, a respectable but vehemently anti-Mongol historian, puts the total for Herat at 2,400,000. Later, more conservative scholars place the number of dead from Genghis Khan's invasion of Central Asia at 15 million within 5 years. Even this more modest total, however, would require that each Mongol kill more than 100 people. The inflated tallies for other cities required a slaughter of 350 people by every Mongol soldier. Had so many people lived in the cities of Central Asia at the time, they could have easily overwhelmed the invading Mongols. Although accepted as fact and repeated through the generations, the numbers have no basis in reality. It would be physically difficult to slaughter that many cows or pigs, which wait passively for their turn. Overall, those who were supposedly slaughtered outnumbered the Mongols by ratios of up to 50-1. The people could have merely run away, and the Mongols would not have been able to stop them. Inspection of the ruins of the cities conquered by the Mongols show that rarely did they surpass a tenth of the population enumerated as casualties. The dry desert soils of these areas preserve bones for hundreds and sometimes thousands of years, yet none of them has yielded any trace of the millions said to have been slaughtered by the Mongols. Genghis Khan would be more accurately described as a destroyer of cities than a slayer of people, because he often razed entire cities for strategic reasons, in addition to revenge or to provoke fear. In a massive and highly successful effort to reshape the flow of trade across Eurasia, he destroyed cities on the less important or more inaccessible routes to funnel commerce into more routes that his army could more easily supervise and control. To stop trade through an area, he demolished the cities down to their very foundations. In addition to the organized destruction of some cities, he depopulated expansive areas of land by the laborious destruction of the irrigation system. Without irrigation, the villagers and farmers left, and the fields reverted to grazing land. This allowed large areas to be set aside for the herds that accompanied the army and were kept as reserves for future campaigns. Just as when he churned up the agricultural land when he left northern China to return to Mongolia, Genghis Khan always wanted a clear area of retreat or advancement where his army could always find adequate pasturage for the horses and for the other animals on which their success depended. After 4 years of campaigning in Central Asia, Genghis Khan was in his 60s. He was at the height of his power without competition from any rival within his tribe, or threat from any enemy external to it. Yet in contrast to this overwhelming success on the battlefront, his family was already, even before he died, tearing itself apart. Leaving the Mongol homeland in the care of his youngest brother, Temüg Öcügen, he had brought all four of his sons with him on the Central Asian campaign, where he hoped that they would not only learn to be better warriors, but also how to live and work together. Unlike conquerors who came to think of themselves as gods, Genghis Khan knew clearly that he was mortal, and he sought to prepare his empire for a transition. In the tradition of the steppe, each son in a herding family received some of each kind of animal that the family owned, as well as the use of some portion of the grazing lands. Similarly, Genghis Khan planned to give each son a miniature empire, reflecting, to the degree practical, the diverse holdings of the whole empire. Each son would be the Khan of a large number of people and herds on the steppe, as well as owner of a large section of territory with cities, workshops, and farms in the sedentary zones. Above the other three, however, one son would be the Great Khan, who would administer the central government, provide a final court of appeal, and, together with the advice of his other brothers, have responsibility for foreign affairs, particularly for making war. The system depended on the ability and willingness of the brothers to work together and to cooperate under the leadership of the Great Khan. Even before he left on the Khwarizm campaign, the plan encountered difficulty when, despite the strong taboos against discussing or preparing for death, he summoned a family hurultai to deal precisely with that subject. The meeting turned into one of the pivotal episodes of Mongol history by bringing together all the rivalries of the past and foreshadowing the way in which his empire would eventually be broken apart. In addition to his sons, Genghis Khan had several of his most trusted men with him to be a part of the discussion, since their agreement and support would also be necessary to guarantee the succession after his death. As the meeting began, the two eldest sons, Jotch and Chagatai, seemed tensely poised, like steel traps, ready to snap. If Ogode, the third son, arrived true to character, he would have already had a few drinks and been mildly inebriated, although it seems unlikely that he would have been completely drunk in his father's presence. Tolu, the youngest, remained quiet and seemed to have disappeared into the folds of the tent, while his older brothers dominated center stage. Genghis Khan opened the family hurultai by explaining the business of selecting a successor. He was quoted as saying that if all my sons should wish to be Khan and ruler, refusing to serve each other, will it not be as in the fable of the single-headed and the many-headed snake? In this traditional fable, when winter came, the snake's competing heads quarreled among themselves and disagreed about which hole was better for them to find refuge in from the cold wind and snow. One head preferred one hole and pulled in that direction, and the other heads pulled in other directions. The other snake, with many tails but only one head, went immediately into one hole and stayed warm throughout the winter, while the snake with many heads froze to death. After explaining the seriousness and importance of the issue, Genghis Khan asked his eldest son, Jotch, to speak first on the matter of succession. Order of seating, walking, speaking, drinking, and eating all carry heavy symbolic value among Mongols even today. By setting this order of speaking, the Khan was publicly emphasizing that Jotch ranked as his eldest son, and this set him up as the likely successor. If the younger sons accepted this order of speaking, it would be tantamount to accepting Jotch's legitimacy and seniority over them. Chagatai, the second son, refused to allow that assumption to pass unstated and untested. Before Jotch could answer his father, Chagatai spoke up loudly. "When you tell Jotch to speak," he defiantly asked his father, "do you offer him the succession?" Then he blurted out the rhetorical question that was intended as a statement of fact, no matter how much Genghis Khan disagreed, about the suspicious paternity of Jotch, who had been born 40 years earlier, but too soon after Bort's rescue from her Merkid kidnappers. "How could we allow ourselves to be ruled by this bastard son of a Merkid?" demanded Chagatai of his father and brothers. Jotch snapped at being called a bastard by his brother. He let loose a scream, lunged across the tent, and seized Chagatai by the collar. The two men pummeled each other. In painfully emotional words that were probably spoken by Genghis Khan himself, but which the secret history attributes to an advisor in an effort to preserve the dignity of the Khan, Chagatai was reminded how much his father loved and respected him. The father pleaded, in obviously painful words, with his sons to understand how different things were in the old days, before the boys were born, when terror ruled the steppes, neighbors fought neighbors, and no one was safe. What happened to their mother when she was kidnapped was not her fault. She didn't run away from home. She wasn't in love with another man. She was stolen by men who came to kill. Genghis Khan almost meekly implored his sons to remember that despite the circumstances of their birth, they all sprang from a single hot womb, and that if you insult the mother who gave you your life from her heart, if you cause her love for you to freeze up, even if you apologize to her later, the damage is done. The counselor reminded the sons how hard both parents worked to create their new nation, and he listed the sacrifices that both of them made to make a better world for their sons. After the long, emotional scene, Genghis Khan knew that he could not impose a choice on his sons that they would reject after his death. he had to negotiate a compromise agreement that all of them would be willing to accept. He invoked his limited parental authority by reasserting that he himself accepted George as his eldest son, and he commanded his other sons to accept this as fact, and not to repeat suspicions about his paternity again. Chagatai submitted to the command of his father, but made it clear that even in abiding by his edict, words could not make it true. Chagatai grinned and said that the game killed by mouth cannot be loaded onto a horse. Game slaughtered by words cannot be skinned. Outwardly, the sons would all recognize George's legitimacy as long as their father lived. But inwardly, they would never do so. Recognizing the legitimacy of George as the eldest son, however, did not guarantee him the succession to the office of Great Khan, because such an important office was supposed to be based upon ability and support from the others, not on age. Having incurred so much anger from his father, Chagatai knew that the father would not then agree to his taking the office of Great Khan, but he still wanted to prevent George from having it. So Chagatai offered the family a compromise, which may have been spontaneously conceived or already agreed upon by the younger siblings. He said that neither he nor George should become Khan. Instead, the succession should fall to their third brother, the mellow, good-natured, hard-drinking Ogode. With no other option open to him other than war, George agreed to this compromise and endorsed Ogode as the successor. Genghis Khan then allotted personal lands and herds to each son by doing what parents always do to quarreling youngsters. He separated George and Chagatai. Mother Earth is broad, and her rivers and waters are numerous. Make up your camps far apart, and each of you rules your own kingdom. I'll see to it that you are separated. He then warned the sons not to behave so that people would laugh at or insult them. The Muslim scholars serving at the Mongol court evidenced a tortured difficulty in recording this event, since for them a man's honor rested on his control of the sexuality of the women around him. It was almost inconceivable that a man as powerful as Genghis Khan might have had a son sired by another man, or even be accused of such a thing by his own sons. Unlike the secret history written by a Mongol and including a full account of the family fight, the first Persian chronicler, Juveni, wrote the conflict out of his history completely by making the family Hurultai into a gathering of serene decorum and complete unanimity. In his version of events, Genghis Khan delivered a beautiful speech on the admirable qualities of Ogode, and all of his sons agreed. The sons obediently laid the knee of courtesy upon the group of fealty and submission and answered with the tongue of obedience, saying, "Who hath the power to oppose the word of Genghis Khan, and who the ability to reject it?" All Ogode's brothers obeyed his commandment and made a statement in writing. With a little more distance from the original events, Rashid al-Din offered a slightly more honest account, but his manuscript has blanks in crucial places that would impugn the honor of Genghis Khan or his wife. He wrote that, because of blank, the path of unity was trodden upon both sides between them. But the good members of the family never uttered that taunt, but regarded his blank as genuine. Whether the blanks were entered into the original work by Rashid al-Din, or made by later scribes copying it, they show the symbolic and political importance of the issue of George's paternity for generations to come. At the end of the emotionally intense family encounter between Genghis Khan and his sons, It is doubtful that anyone knew how far-reaching the effects of this meeting would be. In this family Hurultai, the victors had just carved up the world in a way that would presage the Vienna Congress following the Napoleonic Wars, the Versailles Conference after World War I, and the meetings of the World War II allies at Yalta and Potsdam.